This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Well, money continues to be a theme on the Nolan Show, and public money and how it's spent and how we're going to get ourselves out of this conundrum of there isn't enough money for public services. We're having a look at the pension contributions given to civil service staff in Stormont today. Anyway, all be explained in the programme.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. Tough times ahead for all of us in Northern Ireland when we eventually do get a programme for government. In other words, when the government here, Stormont, sets out how they're going to be spending money, the message is going to be money is tight. And this week, the message to pensioners throughout Northern Ireland is money is so tight that while the Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, said he did not want to do it, in fact, he's written to the Prime Minister saying he doesn't want to do it, pensioners' welfare, their winter fuel benefits have been cut for those people who used to get it. It's only a small number now who receive pension credit or other credits, other benefits, who will continue to get it. So a lot of pensioners are hearing, we'd like to give you this money, but we just cannot do so. So it's within that context that the Nolan Show decided to look at Stormont itself. And we came across something that's very interesting indeed, which is that the Assembly Commission within Stormont pays its staff with your money one of the highest rates of pension contributions that you will see in Northern Ireland. More than what teachers get, more than what firefighters get, more than what council workers get. So for an example, while an employee has a contribution in local government, the local government council scheme, in other words, council workers, while their employer contributes 19% to their pension, the Assembly Commission is giving 34.25% to their employees. You then look at the health service. Health and social care contribute just over 22%. That's the employer, when your employer adds your pension. So our health staff are getting 22%. The Assembly Commission, the 348 staff who are working within it, 34.25%. So in the context of difficult decisions to pensioners, no doubt to other people throughout Northern Ireland, we're interested in this figure, 34.25%. Now, Assembly Commission employees, they work across a range of areas. Some assist our MLAs in their work, scrutinising legislation. Others in this 348 people cohort, they provide advice and support in drafting legislation or in compiling research publications which are made available to members and the public. It's important work. Health staff, 22%. Assembly Commission, 34.25%. Staff members also work in a range of other support roles. The Hansard team, who ensure there's an official record of all Assembly proceedings, 34.2% you pay as a pension contribution, while someone that is a firefighter in Northern Ireland gets 31.1%. Teachers get 29%. Assembly Commission, 34%. as well as free electric car charging. Taking your calls this morning, 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. Should there be a look at this, or actually do you want to attract the very best of people into the Assembly Commission? Anne Watson is joining us this morning. Anne Watson is a member of the Pensioners People's Parliament. Morning to you, Anne.
Morning.
Good morning. How do you feel about this?
Well, I think it's a disgrace because every one of those people that you named, firefighters, teachers, bin men, doesn't matter, the people that sweep the streets, they're all cogs in the wheel of life. And no man is better than any other man.
Or woman.
And they have a wee bit more common sense. The ones sweeping the street might have more common sense than the ones that are in Stormont. Because sometimes you listen to them, you don't think they've any common sense.
Well, no, we're not talking about MLAs here. We're talking about people that are providing support roles in Stormont. But there is at least a question around what is the justification for paying the likes of those bin men 19% towards their pensions and paying Assembly Commission staff nearly double, 34.2%.
There's no justification in it. It's just because they think they're better than the man that's sweeping the street or the person who's minding the kids, and they're not. Because if the person that's minding their kids wasn't minding their kids, they couldn't be doing what they're doing. But the person that's minding their kids doesn't get 34% for their pension. And they'll certainly not be fighting our corner as pensioners. Because I'm all right, Jack, you get on with it.
Well, you've been told by Stormont there's no money
to
maintain what the arrangements were for the winter fuel allowance.
They'll not have no money not to pay them, but when it comes to paying them, they'll find the money for it.
What do you say to them this morning, Anne?
I think they all need to get their act together and be a bit more realistic. I mean, it's not only ordinary, plain pensioners we're talking about, because some of the pensioners do have benefits and will get that. It's the people, the older people who still have that psyche within their brain that they're taking something for nothing if they apply for benefits. And that's the people they need to be looking at, because those are the worst off.
We say that we value, among other services in Northern Ireland, the NHS. So we looked at the NHS.
Yep.
Health and social care employees in Northern Ireland, 22.5%.
Yep. Ridiculous.
Assembly
Absolutely
Commission,
ridiculous.
34%.
Yep. It's crazy. But who thought it all out? The ones that were going to get the 34% decided on it. They made the plan and the ratio as to who was getting what. If they'd asked the ordinary common worker, they would have said everybody should have the same. And why shouldn't they? Because they all contribute to keeping life going on. It's not, they're not doing anything better than anybody else.
And then with this, look, all we're doing today, it's public interest journalism. We're trying to understand from the authorities, given that this payment to Assembly Commission staff is higher than teachers, is higher than firefighting staff, is higher than NHS staff. We asked them a simple question. How is the rate of 34.25% set? What we got was the runaround. The Department of Finance, the Assembly Commission, sent us to the Department of Finance. The Department of Finance sent us back to the Assembly Commission. So we're just getting the runaround. How is it set? Simple question, Anne.
It's set by them. They set their own, and then everybody can look after themselves after that, as long as we're all right.
Paul Gosling is an economist, financial journalist. Morning to you, Paul.
Good morning, Stephen.
We're trying to understand this. We're trying to. There will be many people who appreciate what the staff do, preparing work for our MLAs. Why is there not a consistent figure across Northern Ireland? Can you help me with that in public service?
No, I can't help you with that. What I can say is I think you're correct that there should be a consistent figure across all of the public sector. But I do think it's important we put this in perspective. So I spent 2 years as one of those individuals that benefited from that higher rate of pension contribution by working for an MLA, Sinead McLaughlin, as her parliamentary assistant for 2 years. And I think it's important that people understand that the pay for a parliamentary assistant is less than $30,000 a year. I received less than that because I wasn't working full time. The private sector comparator would be something in the region of twice that, £60,000-£70,000 a year. So for $30,000 a year, you're being paid to do the research for MLAs, to understand the context of what's going on in terms of policy, to read all the papers going to committees, to write the questions going into Stormont. And what I think perhaps has happened is to compensate for a substantial reduction compared with what you would get in the private sector for doing something similar, they're increasing the pension contribution. Now, that is the wrong way to do it. There should be a comparable level of pension contribution across the whole of the public sector. But equally, if we want MLAs to be doing a very good job, we should be paying the proper rates for the job, not trying to compensate.
100%. And there's nothing, Paul, within this discussion, certainly from the Nolan Show this morning. We want our MLAs to be properly researched. We want them to be backed up with really good people. I'm just trying to understand how the health and social care employers in Northern Ireland are contributing 22%, and it's 50% higher for those people doing that research for MLAs in the context of our political system saying there's not enough money for winter fuel allowances for pensioners. There will no doubt be more difficult decisions coming from Stormont. They haven't given the police any more money. Money's really tight. Where's this money coming from for the Assembly Commission?
You're absolutely correct, Stephen. But what I'm suggesting is that the commission, which is actually consisting of senior MLAs on the commission itself, I think what they're trying to do is to compensate for the fact that a lot of the staff are not being paid the proper rate for the job. Now, that is the wrong way for doing it. And actually, if we want Stormont to be effective, we need high-quality MLAs supported by high-quality MLA staff and other people within Stormont. And the problem we've got with dysfunction is partly because we haven't got MLAs and ministers operating to the standard we expect. And that in part is because we perhaps are not paying enough for people to do the job to support them. But the wrong way of doing of supporting that is to pay extra overtime contributions. You're completely right about that. We need to look from basics in terms of how Stormont works. We need to actually come down to the basics about everything that the different departments are paying for and to do a basic check on whether we got the priorities right, because clearly we've got them actually wrong at the moment.
And the Assembly Commission were very, very precise with us. They said to us that these rates, this 34.25% rate, is set by the Department of Finance. So the question is for the Sinn Féin Minister, Caoimhe Archibald. 34.25% to Assembly Commission staff for a pension contribution from your employer. But if you're working in the health service, only 22%. Relatively speaking, that's a lot worse. If you're a firefighter, you're not getting as much. If you're a teacher, you're not getting as much. So Caoimhe Archibald, what is the justification from this? And when we tried to find out from your department sent us back to the Assembly Commission. So we just got the runaround.
The question then is what the Department for Finance itself is contributing to is for its own civil service staff and what the rate is across the whole of the Northern Ireland Civil Service. I think the important thing, Stephen, is to put this into perspective, which I think MLAs and ministers are not doing sufficiently, which is we are not actually getting value for money out of the executive departments. we are not actually prioritising what needs to be spent. For example, supporting people in poverty, improving the health service, getting the health service back on track. And we've got far too many things that are lower priorities that are actually being funded, where the key priorities are not being funded. So we, I think, need to keep that in perspective, really.
The other thing that the Assembly Commission is doing, look, and it's for you to decide whether it's right that they're doing this or not. I'm prompting the conversation this morning. They give an interest-free loan, so that costs taxpayers money, for annual commuter cards. They will pay for subscription fees for their staff if they're required to be a professional body linked to the role, and they provide free car parking beside Parliament buildings on the Stormont Estate. So you start to think to yourself, well, if the parking wasn't free, would that be a revenue raiser? It would be small, but it would be tokenistic. But you pay for parking, a nurse pays for parking when they're going to a hospital. A nurse pays, a porter going in to work in our hospitals is getting a 22% pension contribution and is paying for their parking. Assembly Commission staff, you're paying for that land, and it's free. Now, we are not targeting Assembly Commission staff this morning. We're asking, while Stormont hands out these difficult messages to other employers, to other taxpayers in Northern Ireland, what are they doing? How much are they looking at themselves? 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call. Sorry, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, you're completely right about this, Stephen. But I think we have to keep into perspective that there is no clear prioritisation by ministers of what money should be spent, how public money should be spent. Now, I wrote a piece for the Belfast Telegraph last week saying that we need to undertake what's called a zero-based budgeting exercise, which means basically we start all over again from zero. So nothing is assumed to be the right expenditure and everything has to be argued for. And I do not believe that at the moment we are spending the right priorities. I mean, clearly our health service is in pieces. And I do not believe that everything that is being paid across the board of departments is of equal priority. And we need to start from arguing for everything that is being spent on an equal basis.
Jerry's in Roscommon. Morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Stephen. I'm just listening to the programme there. And 2 points I'd like to make. The civil servants who are now working in the Assembly, sure, they were all transferred from different departments in Stormont. You know, so there was no big deal. There was nobody had to be re-employed or anything. And the other point I'd like to make is when the Assembly was down for so long, months, maybe more than months, so maybe it was a couple of years, what were the civil servants doing all that time? And the other thing, I think the man that they should bring back, who really should be the CEO of Northern Ireland, is Andrew McCormick. They should send him in as a time and motion man to see what everybody's doing in Stormont.
Have you noticed also, Jerry, somebody said this to me yesterday, that we then look at our political leaders. Can anybody tell me, in terms of our First and Deputy First Minister, have they actually been front and centre with the public talking about policy in Northern Ireland? Have
no.
They? There's a public sector job freeze in Scotland. That's what they're doing there to address the financial situation in Scotland. We've seen the Prime Minister talking about what's happening in England and Wales with regards to, for example, the Pensioners' Winter Fuel Allowance. He's been talking about the budget. Has Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly, have you seen them standing up talking to us all about policy in Northern Ireland?
Never. Never. The other thing Stephen cannot say, you know, at the end of the day, the buck stops with the MLAs. When was a civil servant ever sacked? And if you look at the cash for ice scheme, I mean, civil servants drew all that all up. Who was held responsible for it? None of them. But at the end of the day, because civil servants, and if you don't mind me using the term, they're bulletproof. You know, so at the end of the day, the civils or the MLA should take the rap for all what's going wrong. They're getting big money, so I think the people should now speak and tell them to get their house in order.
So the head of communications for the Northern Ireland Assembly has been in touch with us just in the last few minutes, 22 minutes past nine, we received this email. And he said, the Assembly's not unique. The only thing unique is that we've replied to your query. The Assembly is part of the civil service scheme, so this is not a commission-only figure. So this applies throughout the whole of the civil service, is what I'm reading from that. 34.25%. So Shimeon Lee from the Taxpayers Alliance with us this morning. Good morning to you, Shimeon.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. The context here, I keep on saying it, the context is when you've got a political body, in other words, Stormont, which is going to be delivering difficult decisions for people in Northern Ireland, how much are they looking at themselves in terms of where money might be saved or how they're going to justify money to the public that's being spent within their entity?
Well, I think it's very clear that public sector pensions are in dire need of reform. You mentioned the 34% employer contribution in the Northern Ireland civil service. Now, that's actually far higher than the sort of employer contributions in the UK public sector at large, which is about 27%. And even that 27% figure is actually far, far higher than what everybody else in the private sector gets. Employer contributions in the private sector are actually just around 4%. So the civil service and the public sector are actually receiving far, far more in employer contributions than everyone else in the private sector. And this is a big problem because we've got about £2.5 trillion worth of unfunded pension liabilities in this country. And that's equivalent to the entire national debt. And that's actually growing massively, about 47% in the past 4 years. And I think the fact of the matter is that public sector pensions, they're unfunded, they're unfair, and they're unsustainable.
Well, the point that Paul Gosling's making, Shimeon, and I'm sure he can make it himself to you, is that sometimes this very high, relatively speaking, pension contribution is to offset against these people not being paid enough.
Well, I think if we look at the numbers of what people in the public sector are actually being paid, we actually find that people in the public sector are paid 8% higher than their counterparts in the private sector. And in addition to this 8% higher pay, they also receive a pension that's worth up to six times more. The value of their pension is actually worth six times more than in the private sector. So if you look at someone from the ages to about 55 to 65, someone at the end of their career, you'll see that in the public sector, the value of their pension is about £210,000. Now, that compare that to someone of that same age group in the private sector, their pension's worth just £30,000. So that's actually a huge inequality there. And the TPA has actually done, a Taxpayers Alliance has actually done a research paper looking at this topic. And we find that if you include pension contributions to their pay in the public sector, remuneration, total remuneration, has actually risen about 8.8 percentage points above inflation since 2009. So it's not true to say that the public sector actually receives less than the private sector.
So we've also, Paul Gosling, some of what the has been sent through to us by the Director of Communications up there, He has sent us through an advisory as to what's actually going on. It's a real pity we're only getting this at 22 minutes past nine this morning. But we're grateful to Mr. Kearns for sending this to us. So up until April of this year, salary bands 1 and 2, the lower salary bands, had employers' contributions of 28.7% and 30.7%. The Stormont machine has been able to find extra money to bring those people up on salary bands 1 and 2 to 34.25%. So there's been more money found within the Stormont machine. And all they were doing there, Paul, which is interesting in itself, they were bringing the lowest paid up to what the highest paid were always getting. So the highest paid, those people earning 58,700 and over, they were getting 34.2%.
What I think the answer from the assembly body has indicated, Stephen, is as I suggested, which is that this is an issue for the whole Northern Ireland Civil Service rather than simply for Stormont. And I think your caller earlier was absolutely correct in saying there needs to be substantial reform of the Northern Ireland Civil Service. RHI is one example, and the fact that we don't have effective processes for reviewing the quality of work of individual civil servants that work sufficiently well. And I think there needs to be a fundamental reform, not just of Stormont, but of the civil service. And actually, we're not getting the outcomes that we expect. And I think focusing too much on the individual rates of pension contribution is at risk of overlooking the fact that we're not getting the quality of service across the civil service that we expect as a society.
Jerry's in Roscommon. Morning, Jerry.
Stephen. The people who draw up the pension schemes are civil servants in the Department of Finance. So they're drawing up their own pension scheme and what they're getting paid. And the other thing is...
Well, the Department of Finance. So we're being told that the Department of Finance, Jerry, you've already been on, we're being told that the Department of Finance have set this rate.
Yeah, but, you know, that's great. I wish we all could set up our pensions and tell the state what we would like to have, you know.
Let me bring in Colin Portadown. Morning, Colin.
Stephen, hi. Just a wee quick question on behalf of the vast amount of licence fee payers to the BBC.
Yeah.
What does the BBC percentage rate-wise pay towards your percent pension?
My pension?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I think it's 3% and it's capped on the D-line one. It's capped.
3%?
Yeah.
I think you should be complaining about that one on the MLAs.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, that's a surprise. I'll double check that, by the way, just in case you've got your figures wrong.
I think I'm pretty sure it is. And if I've got that wrong, I'm sorry. I'm taking that off the top of my head, but it's certainly, that's what I think. And if I've got that wrong, I'll come back to you and tell you.
I'll come back to you because I'm going to write to the BBC today.
Well, good man. Good man. That'll save me from having to do it. Of course, the BBC will probably tell you, well, we can't talk about individual staffing matters, but I can choose to.
I'll write to the newspapers then.
Okay. Well, what do you think of this story?
I'll tell you, Swiss, couldn't care less.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Jared and Downpatrick. Morning, Jared.
Hello.
Couldn't care less. I love Northern Ireland. Go ahead, Jared.
Well, it's just that you were looking about wanting to find ways for the pensioners to have money for their heating. And the way the system is, I'm an employer, and I've never seen it as bad, but I get people who would phone me up looking for work with cash in hand. And it would happen quite often.
Jared, I forgot about the news. Stay there. One second. Just one second. Yeah, stay there. We'll take the news.
You said the news is more important than me.
We'll come back in a second. Jared's in Downpatrick. Morning, Jared.
Morning, how you doing?
Go ahead, Jared.
Right, well, you were just saying there about, you know, the pensioners needing money for their fuel, for their winter heating, which is correct. You know, they all do. And a money part where that could come from is literally, as much as that might be, it's getting rid of cash out of society, because the amount of people that would phone me up looking for jobs. I run a small cleaning business. And they're blatantly wanting cash in hand and their own benefits when there is absolutely, because I've asked them about ladder work, about, you know, working outside, able to do everything and are claiming benefits for nothing. There was one particular fellow there just recently and he told me he was on benefits, but he was out and sick. He's all well, 100%, looking back to work. He was on 570 every 2 weeks and a further 620 once a month. He wants cash in hand, 10 an hour, £400 a week, £1,600 a month. which would bring him in the nearly £50,000 a year on benefits, and obviously the cash. That's what's wrong with people. I had another one yesterday wanting £500 a week cash in hand.
It's obviously a different story than what we're talking about today, but you're saying there's a lack of work ethic in Northern Ireland. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that would be... It's because
obviously the vast majority of people listening to this program will be screaming at you that they're in work, they're at work, they're going to work.
There's quite a lot of people are, and kudos to
there
them.
There are quite a lot of people on benefits that don't want to be smeared by you that they're doing something wrong. They're sick or they're entitled to those benefits or they're working.
100%. Yeah, there's ones there that absolutely do deserve to work and who deserve the benefits, and need them and need the backup for it. But there's ones there who are blatantly abusing it.
Yeah.
And that's the ones, that's who I'm particularly targeting here. Not the ones who are needing it, not the ones who can't work because there's something happened to them, and the ones who are actually physically able, nothing wrong with them, and completely messing the system up. I believe if we went a cashless society, then we would actually have a massive return to workforce, and we would also have the money for the pensioners for their heating.
So in the context of what we're talking about today, which is essentially, look, if there is this pain coming to Northern Ireland, if Stormont, when they eventually do have a programme for government, are undoubtedly going to say they wish they had more money, you're saying they should also be thinking about those people who are paying cash in hand, getting paid cash in hand, and therefore that's a loss of revenue to the Exchequer. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, a huge loss of revenue.
Of course, that tax money would go into the central treasury, wouldn't it? It wouldn't come to Northern Ireland.
I'm not sure where it would go. I know the tax money would be beneficial for a lot of people, health services and everything else that would be here.
Sure.
That deficit would certainly make up. I mean, there's people there who would work, you know, through the week, and they're flat out working and they're putting everything through the books and they have a wee cash shop. I don't really mean to upset them because they're working and deserve a wee extra tip, you know, and that might be contradictory from what I'm saying.
If we come back to what we're talking about today, if civil servants in Northern Ireland are getting a 34.25% pension contribution, should Stormont award that same pension contribution to our police officers, to our firefighters, to our teachers, to our NHS staff?
It would have to be one for all. It has to be a one-tier system, shouldn't it? I mean, they're all on the same government body, so they all should have the one-tier system on a pension thing, yeah. I mean, the pay rates for different people for different jobs certainly is always going to be different, but if it's 10% for every government person, it should be the same, or if it's 34.5 or whatever you were saying there, should be that.
Paul, I know you've said this already. I know you've said this already, Paul Gosling, because you're the financial expert we've got on this morning. But why is it not a consistent flat rate fee across the public sector? Help me understand that, Paul. Why not?
Because the public sector isn't a single integrated body. It is a collection of individual organisations that basically manage themselves. So you have these inconsistencies across different parts of the public sector. There's no overall single decision-making organisation that says, well, this is how pension contributions should be set. And actually, you need to understand also that while some of the public sector pensions do not have employer contributions on a on-you-go basis, others do. So you've got differences in the way that the public sector pensions
are. But who would set the pension rate for example, our NHS staff? Who would set the employer, that's what we're talking about today, the amount that the employer contributes towards a staff pension? Would that be the Health and Social Care Boards? Would that be the Department of Health? Who would that be?
I'm assuming that it would be Department of Health, and that they would tell the individual boards, the individual trusts, what rates should be paid.
But,
and it may well be that that is set from a UK-wide negotiating process.
But here's where I'm going with this.
Trusts and the unions.
You're saying these are disparate bodies, right?
Yes.
But the Department of Finance sets the rate for the civil service.
Yes.
So surely the Department of Finance would be highly influential as to how all of these other public sector workers are paid in terms of what the money that's available for pension contributions. So we're being told the Department of Finance have signed off. They've decided civil servants should get 34.25%. How could the Department of Finance argue anything but... How could the Department of Finance argue that an NHS worker should only get 22% then?
Because individual employment arrangements in individual public sector bodies are agreed through negotiations between the employers and the trade unions. And therefore, you get inconsistent settlements.
But the moral argument,
the public sector. Oh, morally, you are completely right. I'm just saying, in practical terms, that's not how things are decided.
William's in Armagh. Morning, William.
Hello, Stephen. This thing about inequality and pensions, of course, it's rampant. So it is in the health service, for instance. More or less from the start of COVID, we needed increased supply of agency nurses. Now, an agency nurse, I'm just using this example. Don't know the proper rate. As an employed nurse in the health service, say, for example, could be getting £10 an hour. An agency nurse will be getting £15 an hour for doing the exact same work. And lots of nurses now are leaving the health service to go into these agencies. It's like a vicious circle feeding of itself. And nobody seems to be concerned about that. You could be standing beside someone who's on £10 an hour and another person doing the exact same work is on £15 an hour.
Again, that's a different subject, but an important subject, and it comes within this whole the whole umbrella that if money's tight, we're going to have difficult decisions coming up here. Then should there be a review of all spending in Northern Ireland? William, thank you.
Right.
Shimon Lee, you've said that the civil service here in Northern Ireland. Can I check this? Are you telling us that the pension contribution for the civil service here is not on a par with across the water with where you are?
Yeah, so the employer contribution in the Northern Ireland civil service is about 34.25%, as you mentioned, but the average of the employer pension contributions for the UK public sector, so that's the civil service in the UK, the NHS and teachers' pensions, that's an average about 27%. Of course, this is far, far higher.
Yeah, but you can't average it out, can you? You can't compare apples with oranges. The comparison that I'm asking you to make is between the civil service here and the civil service in England, for example. Do you have those figures?
The civil service in England, I believe, are paid something like the employer contribution for them is about 28, 29%. So it is higher in Northern Ireland.
And what do you think of that?
Well, I think the reason why these public sector pensions are so much higher than the private sector, but just high in general, is because a lot of these pension schemes are unfunded. That means that there hasn't been money set aside to pay for the benefits that we've promised to people that have already retired. What that means is that current pension, current employer contributions and current employee contributions go towards paying current payouts. And because these payouts are based on the wages that these public sector workers have earned during their lifetime, that's what causes the amount of employer contributions to be so high, because the employer contributions are set in order to be able to pay for the sort of pension benefits that are being paid out to pensioners today. That's the reason why these figures are so high.
Wayne's a more on point. Morning, Wayne.
Morning, Steve. Steve, what I've been hearing there this morning is like they got a lovely pay raise of 37%, whatever the case is, and everything's higher in Northern Ireland. But everything's so high, but yet we have nothing. You know what I mean? They can't find money for anybody else but paying 35-37%. As far as I know, we have more civil servants than anybody regarding in GB. But yet...
Well, I don't know that.
My question
I
is,
don't know that. Where are you getting that from?
I think per population per head, we do have more, because we have only 1.9 million people in Northern Ireland, and I think I'm nearly right on that one, Stephen. You can check it out yourself. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I apologise. But my question is, can you sit down and tell me, you said to me Scotland have a pay freeze.
Public sector pay freeze.
But, in government. But hold on here. They deliver. They deliver. These governments like Wales, Scotland, England, whatever, they all deliver. Northern Ireland doesn't deliver anything. If you can sit down and write down on a piece of paper...
Well, Scotland have problems with their health services too. But look, you know...
Yeah, but
you can find criticism of any administration, can't you? But
no,
is there a momentum?
Don't. That's a get-out clause. That is a get-out clause for Northern Ireland. You can find excuse for criticism. If somebody can turn around and tell me what Stormont has delivered in 10 years, I'll eat my hat. Because so far I can see they've delivered nothing for nobody, for education, for health, for the elderly, or nothing.
Well,
they only seem to find a deliver for themselves.
Well, well, here's what I'll tell you. Here's what I'll tell you. To be fair to Mike Nesbitt, the health minister, he stood up and he said that he would protect certain services. Do you remember? Just a couple of months ago, he stood up. He was just became the health minister, and he said certain cuts to the health budget, not on my watch, were Mike's words. So that was a minister protecting the health brief. Paul Given, the education minister, he has introduced. Listen to me, Paul Given, because you just can't level these criticisms if they're not accurate. Paul Given, the education minister, has introduced a new policy around protecting children from being distracted with mobile phones just yesterday. Paul Given has introduced a school building program in Northern Ireland in recent months. Naomi Long was up in McGabbery Prison. Naomi Long was up in McGabbery Prison. I think that was yesterday as well, with a solar panel scheme. Andrew Muir from the Alliance Party, our environment minister, he's been on the news talking about water pollution. So it's just not true to say these people are doing nothing. It's not true. Kiva Archibald is fighting for more money from the British Treasurer. She's our finance minister.
Yeah, and what are they going to do with it? She won't get it for starters because they won't give them any more money because the fact is they're the most bunch of irresponsible children with money you ever seen in your life. They can throw money around like it's absolutely insane and then they can't account.
But where are they throwing
it?
Money around? Where? Where? These words coming from you, where?
My point is, how come the health service is in such a state for 10 years because they walked out for five and they didn't implement a bulk-grant budget because they got their money and they played tootsie with each other for 5 years. So we're 5 years behind investment with no budget. Education's the same. The pensioners are the same. They've actually taken their winter allowance off them. They're going to try to get it. Why would they not give them it? Because they can't manage money and they won't put the guarantee in place that they won't walk out of government. If they did that some of their parties requested, Westminster would be happy to give them. Westminster do not trust the Stormont government to stay in government, so therefore is there an exceptionally high risk of investment.
Well, you had Andrew McCormick Andrew McCormick, a former senior civil servant. There's nobody in the civil service doesn't know who Andrew McCormick is. All those senior politicians know exactly who he is. He was there for years. He's since left. When I asked him the other day if Stormont has a good reputation with the Treasury, he said he near choked and laughed and said no.
Correct. The answer to the question.
Wynne, thank you. Paul Gosling, where do we go from here? What do we do from here?
The fundamental question on all this stuff is how to get the political parties to work together in ways that are actually cooperative and positive. And that is a problem that I have no answer to. I mean, I do believe that you need to go back to day one, have a blank sheet of paper, and then argue for every item of expenditure. I don't think until you do that, you'll get the investment that's needed, for example, in social care. And if you don't get the investment in social care, then you're going to have hospitals that are full of people that can't be discharged and blocking up beds. And if you don't get the health service working, then you're not going to get the employment rate up higher because you've got too many people that are ill and can't work. So all these problems are interlocking, yet we've got a system of government that does not cooperate between the departments. And that's partly to do with the civil service also operating individually rather than collectively. But in particular, it's about ministers not working together. And unless we can get a real value for money assessment of all public sector expenditure in Northern Ireland, we're not going to move forward and solve our problems.
Okay. Paul, thank you. Shimeon, thank you very much. Morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. Now, children across Northern Ireland went back to school this week. One who should have been back to school is 11-year-old Aidan. Aidan has severe learning difficulties and autism, and has been attending Fleming Fulton in Belfast since he was in P4. But in June, his parents were informed that Aidan would not be allowed back to school to complete P7, despite not being formally expelled. So he's no school place. What's going on? Aidan's mum, Sinead, is with us this morning. Good morning, Sinead.
Good morning, Stephen.
So what is going on? What's happened?
So Aidan has been in Fleming Fulton School for 2 years now, and just back in April there, they were saying to me his behaviours had changed. He was been okay at home. He was okay in his after-school club and his swimming club. And then after a few weeks, they had said to me that they couldn't keep cope with his needs and reduced him to 2 hours a day. They had removed him from his classroom as well. First of all, when he was in his class, he never got a one-on-one teacher. They had requested it from the Education Board, which they had refused. Then when they moved Aidan out of the class, the school had requested it again, and then the Education Board had accepted it. But he sat on for 2 hours a day from maybe the end of April, beginning of May, until the middle of June. Now, there was multiple meetings in between that with myself, the school and the Education Board. And then in the middle of June, there was another meeting, and they just said that Flannery Fitton had just said he's being removed from the school because we don't have the facilities and the needs to look after him. At that stage, he was getting paid for two staff. So at first he hadn't done, then he got one when he was removed from the class. Then he'd got two full-time assistants to help with him, but they still removed him from the school to say that they can't help and support his needs.
So can I walk through the basics of this so I'm understanding this?
Yeah.
So your son was in school in Fleming Fulton.
Yeah.
And he was there every day, full-time hours, like other children?
Yeah, P5, P6, yeah.
Which is 9 to what? 9 to 3, something like that?
9 to 3, yeah.
So what happened that they then said he can't be there 9 to 3?
They said his behaviour changed. He was lashing out and throwing things in class. So when they asked the Education Board for a one-on-one, they refused. So that's when they removed him from the class. I didn't see any changes at home. Now, don't get me wrong, well, he does
the
have
Education Authority are saying something completely different. They're saying that a bespoke package of additional support, this is after we went to them, they have told us that they have given a bespoke package of additional support to ensure your son will reach his full potential.
Yeah, they do now, but at the beginning in April, Aidan didn't have a one-on-one assistant, which he should have always had from school. He didn't have that back in April. The school had put in for it maybe twice, and it was rejected. It was only when the school decided that he wasn't safe in a class around other children, he was removed from the class, then the Education Board gave an assistant. And now at the moment, they've got two assistants, and I think there may be a teacher. I got a phone call from the school yesterday, and there's going to be a meeting tomorrow. They're looking to bring him back part-time on Monday, just Aidan on his own in his own classroom.
This is after we've been involved in this, asking questions, is it?
Yeah. That's for the help of your team, Stephen, yeah, and help from Taylor. Tell him thank you very much for that, yeah. But I wasn't getting any contact until I received a call from the school yesterday. When I received a call from you yesterday morning, then the school rang me yesterday afternoon.
But I'm sorry that I'm confused about this if it's just me.
Yeah.
But if your son was through no fault of his own, because of his disability, he's lashing out, they can't cope with him in a full day. How could they cope with him for 2 hours? I can't understand how he's either there or he's not. So
yeah, it's the same. I mean, they're saying it's staffing issues. They need more staff. To be honest, I think it was more to do with funding and money. That's my opinion. I could be wrong. Because when they removed him from the class, that's when the classroom assistant came. They want two assistants and a full-time teacher just for Aidan on his own, in his own classroom. Three staff just to cope with him. Now, don't get me wrong, he has behavioural issues, but I think that might be a bit extreme, three staff. So
when you say behavioural issues, have staff got injured? Again, through no fault of your son because of his disability, but have other staff been injured by your son?
Yes, staff have been injured.
So that's the complexity of this, isn't it?
Yeah. But the thing is, staff have been injured, but so was Aidan in the process. But the staff was sent to be checked up by the nurse and sent to the hospital when Aidan wasn't. So if Aidan's the one injuring himself, for example, He headbutted a board, like a whiteboard on the wall, and it fell off and it hit one of the systems on the hand. The system was sent to the school nurse and sent to the hospital, but no care was done for Aidan.
Well,
and I'd ask, why wasn't he sent to the nurse? Why wasn't he informed to be sent to the hospital when he was injured also?
We would need to ask about that, and that's your understanding of what's happened. Fleming Fulton might have a different understanding as well, and we'll see if they've given us any information of their side about that. So, Sinead, what you want is you want your son educated, like any mum. You want your son in school. So there's movement at least, isn't there?
Yeah. So he will be brought back in next week, but it will be reduced hours, and that's why he started in the whole month of in May and June. But the problem is, it's like most autistic kids, they need routine. When he's taken out of that routine, that's what sets him off. So if he's having to be brought to school for a couple of hours a day by myself instead of the transport, and he's in a different class and he's around different people, that's a different routine to him. He needs to get back into his proper routine. Yeah. I understand the school are worried about the safety of others, but if he doesn't be slowly but surely brought into the class and get back into his routine, he is going to be upset because it's a change for him.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's what we're all sort of started off when all the strikes were happening. No fault of the staff striking, because I agree with him 100%. But he was getting out of routine. The buses were off. The schools were off. He wasn't getting in. He was putting all over the place. Then he was brought in on reduced hours. Then he was with different staff. You know, so all this changes had affected his temper, but I don't understand what happened to him in school and why he changed, because it only seemed to be school that he was changing in.
Well, look, will we do this? You say that there's movement in this. Why don't you stay in touch with us here at the Nolan Show regarding your son's education, and we'll stay with this story. Is that all right, Sinead?
Yes. Right. I'd like to thank you again, and also like to say as well, the staff and planning are brilliant. You know, it's not always the staff.
I get it. They'll get it too.
The assistants were good.
You're fighting for your son to get an education. They'll understand that. We understand it too. Sinead, thank you. Get the news. Good morning, everyone. Well, look, during the Nolan Show this morning, the Department of Finance, this is during the programme, we were talking to them yesterday and we described to you how we were getting the runaround earlier in the programme. The Department of Finance, having heard today's programme, have now decided to give you more information about the pension contribution, the employer pension contribution, using your taxpayers' money. To the simple question that we asked, how is this rate of 34.25% set? That's what we asked. Department of Finance have now decided to tell you. And here's their answer. The legislation governing all public service pension schemes, including the scheme for the Northern Ireland Civil Service, requires that employer contributions are subject to regular review in scheme valuations undertaken by qualified actuaries. These valuations assess income, costs and liabilities for the scheme. The results are used to calculate the appropriate employer contribution and share of costs between employers and scheme members required to meet the obligations for pensions and payment to retired scheme members. The current employer contribution rates were put in place from 1st of April 2024 based on the last completed valuation, which is published at, and then it's a link to the Department of Finance. We'll put that on my Twitter feed. The next valuation for the Northern Ireland Civil Service Scheme is underway, and when complete will be used to set the updated employer contribution rate from the 1st of April 2027. You see, I still don't understand, and we'll delve into this further. So Department of Finance are saying the legislation governing all public service pension schemes. Well, how come then health workers on a public service pension scheme are on 22% and civil servants are on 34%? How come? It's a simple question. How come our firefighters and our teachers aren't getting the same employer pension contribution? We also can tell you that in that pension for the civil service, that 34.2% pension contribution, that is being given to 29,574 people in Northern Ireland, and it's costing you £294 million. This year it cost 280 million in 22-23, 270 million 21-22, 255 million in 2021. So the current taxpayer liability for the employer contributions to civil servants in Northern Ireland is costing 294,115,000 pounds. And as we look more on that story and understand it more, we will, of course, continue with our coverage about it. Now, next, the PSNI has published new statistics that show race-related incidents have increased by a third in the last year. That amounts to an increase of more than 400 reports compared to the previous 12 months. 45 arrests have been linked to the disorder, of which 7 are children. Policing, street violence and racially motivated attacks in the last month has cost the PSNI £3.5 million on top of their normal operations. Here's Assistant Chief Constable Bobby Singleton.
In terms of my assessment around race hate crime, deeply concerned by what we've seen over the last month. A lot of those incidents will happen very deliberately in the dead of night, so as there are no witnesses. And as a consequence of that, in more than 40% of those cases, no suspect will be identified. I guess what I'm more concerned about is the fact that in many instances, either the victims themselves or in fact other people in the community will know who is responsible for those attacks. But at present, they don't feel comfortable enough to be able to come forward and tell the police as to who those people are because they're scared about retribution.
The Belfast Telegraph columnist Malachy Docherty has been writing about this, and you've been saying, Malachy, we need to deal with this by accepting that racism is deeply embedded in our traditions and culture.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I see a kind of a pattern developing in the way in which it's been perceived recently, where it's basically being assumed, you know, that this is some new kind of outburst of anger, particularly within the Protestant Unionist Loyalist community. And yet I cast my mind back, you know, to school days when we passed around jokes in the classroom about Jews and about Sambo and Lulabel and stuff. And I remember times when I've been in Belfast working alongside black colleagues and heard the remarks made by people on the, you know, in the periphery or to me when I wasn't in the company of those colleagues. And I remember I described an incident in the article where I'm in a black taxi coming up the Falls Road, and we saw some black soldiers, you know, on patrol on the Falls Road, and somebody in the car said, "Oh, look at them, just hardly down from the trees, and they're giving them guns and sending them over here," and everybody laughing at that, you know. So I do think that racism is endemic here, but I also think racism is pretty much inevitable everywhere. I think, you know, everyone is going to be curious, wary of the stranger or of difference. And I think we had an interviewee just on the news there talking about the vapid comments. and saying that we need proper law and proper education. And he's right, you know, you need almost to, you need to deal with this very early, and you need to avoid something developing as well here, which is a kind of a sense that Protestants are bigots and Catholics are not, you know, because there's plenty of that that behind the cuff, behind under the hand, sneering at difference and sneering at race, you know, within all communities here.
Dr. Raed Al-Wazan is a member of the Belfast Islamic Centre with us this morning as well. Raed, good morning to you.
Good morning.
This statistic, Raed, that that we're looking at, that there have been more than 400 reports of race-related incidents compared to the previous 12 months. Might that be slightly misleading if the context of the race riots that have just happened last month are not taken into account? Is it really getting that much worse in terms of how much racism is embedded in our society from one year to the next? Or did the race riots bring these racists out onto the streets?
Well, actually, this number is actually the tip of the iceberg. There are more incidents than what has been reported. Many people still feel, you know, scared to report them. And so we will see the number growing up. What we've seen in the last 4 weeks, a month, now more people coming forward and reporting every incident. So that's why you see the statistic, it's higher than the previous year. But to be honest, this figure is still lower than the actual what's happened on the ground.
What is happening on the ground?
There are more racist attacks and people are not reporting them. They are just fear of, you know, might happen to them, you know, especially because now everybody knows there is an element of the paramilitary involved in some of these attacks. So people are just either moving houses or just going somewhere else or not reporting it. Or sometimes, you know, they just not enough evidence for the police to take the case forward.
And they're afraid of what? Getting burnt out or getting their windows bricked? Or is that it?
Yes, that's a bit of further attack from the paramilitary or the people involved with the paramilitary.
This is what I'm hearing as well. I'm involved. I have friends within the Indian Asian community in Northern Ireland. And I was at an event recently at the Public Records Office with them, a celebration of Indian independence. And this is what people were telling me also. I was saying to them, but this is awful. I'm hearing about these attacks. I hope you're okay. And they're saying, you know, well, actually, there's an awful lot more that are not being reported. And that's obvious even from Bobby Singleton's own statistics. If he says there's been a third increase, then we're not seeing anything like that scale of reportage. So clearly there's a lot of this going on that, as Dr. Rydell is saying, is not being reported, is not being discussed in the public sphere, and is generating a degree of fear among minority communities in Northern Ireland, which is far, far greater than perhaps most of us are aware of.
And you have called on political leaders, to unionist leaders, to
yes.
attend a rally at Chancery Square. Why are you doing that?
Well, to be honest, you know, the political leader should take the lead. Well, first of all, we need to storm all the political parties to introduce the hate crime legislation. So the police now and the justice system need the legislation to do their job properly. Northern Ireland is the only part of UK and Ireland does not have hate crime legislation. So that's one point. Second point, to solve this problem as well, we need more boots on the ground from the PSNI. I know the budget is very tight, as you covered in your program, and everybody fighting for extra money, but we need extra money from London. This will not come from the Stormont budget. It should come from London because of the paramilitary involvement here. PSNI fighting the paramilitary, not only like their counterparts in England. So they need extra funds and extra boot on the ground. And thirdly, as you mentioned, yes, we need the loyalist political leaders to take the lead.
Do you not think they're doing that?
To be honest, I don't think they are doing enough. So what we need them to do, because there are lots of good people in the loyalist community who are not approve of this. And I've seen many of them 3 weeks ago in big rally in Belfast, 15,000 attend. Many of them from loyalist background and unionist background. they are not supporting this racist attack. So we need the unionist leaders to call for a rally for the good people in the unionist community to come out and say this is not in our name.
What do you think of that idea, Maliki?
I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, I do think there's been some kind of ambiguity from some of the unionist voices we've heard, because what you're getting from some of them is the argument that there may be a legitimate case to be made by these protesters, but this is not the way to go about it. And the danger of that thinking is that it ignores the plain, simple racism in the behaviour of the protesters and the behaviour of the attackers.
Well, now, come on. No. To be fair to those unionist leaders who have said that, and I don't know who you're talking about, but to be fair to them, there is legitimate protest and legitimate logic with some of the protesters who have opinions on the government's immigration policy, who have opinions on how much pressure it puts on local services. Those are legitimate democratic views,
Stephen,
aren't they?
They are indeed.
And not every protester is a rotter, obviously.
Yeah, people are entitled to make their case about it. But I want to separate those two things. I want to say that people who are out on the streets attacking
absolutely
people from ethnic minorities are not engaged in protest on for the sake of improving the quality of life in the country. They're basically expressing their hatred for minorities, for people of other cultures and other communities.
Well, Dr. Ray Dolvazan, have you written to the unionist leaders asking them to put on this rally?
No, I haven't done that.
Why not?
Just too busy helping some of these victims and doing lots of other things on the ground. Supporting.
Are you going to write to them?
I will do so, yes.
Okay.
Well, I hope they will listen to your program. So,
they all listen.
But you are doing me a good job here by, I will call them publicly here in your program to call for a rally. And I will be the first one to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and address the rally.
Okay. Well, look, what we'll do is we'll contact. So who are you talking about here? You're talking about Gavin Robinson. If you're talking about the unionist leaders, Mike Nesbitt.
All the unionist leaders.
Why would you not want this rally attended by all the leaders, no matter whether they're unionist or nationalist? I'm interested in why you're distinguishing.
Call for that, I'm sure if they call for that rally, other politicians will join them, because in 3 weeks ago, other parties was presented on that rally in center of Belfast. So I'm sure other parties will join, because this is going to be a common issue. Everybody will be there.
Yeah, I think Dr. Rydell is a danger in the idea of being promoted or extended that essentially racism in Northern Ireland is a Protestant loyalist phenomenon, and I think you just have to be a wee bit, it obviously is to a degree. There's more loyalist paranoia involvement in it than from other sides of the community. But we have an historic problem here of division as well, which is this ghastly sectarianism which divides communities. And it's far, far worse in many ways than the racism, because we have the city demarcated by walls, segregate where people live. It's a really, really... So essentially, come at it with an understanding of that as well. And as a call simply to unionist and loyalist leaders, stand up and say this is not on our behalf, is something which continues with the definition of our society as a divided one.
The other elephant in the room here, Maliki, is how society referred to paramilitaries. Now, why am I linking that to this? Because the police have said that there was a paramilitary element in the riots in Northern Ireland. And what do we do here? What do some people who are respected within the community do? They give paramilitaries a place in Northern Ireland society.
Bobby Singleton's language I thought was a wee bit strange, when he said that they didn't think that the loyalist paramilitaries themselves were organising this, but he says they weren't doing anything to stop it, So in a sense, he is kind of crediting them with some responsibility to do something about it, whereas actually we should be saying to the loyalist paramilitaries and the other paramilitaries, you have no responsibilities and no place in this society at all, just get lost.
All right.
That's what he should be
saying.
All
right. Dr. Red Al-Wazan, thank you very much for coming on this morning. Malachy, thank you as well. Time for one more story today. Tougher rules on outdoor smoking could be on the way after Labour politicians have talked up potential plans to curb the use of tobacco products. Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, has said his government needs to take action in order to reduce the burden on the NHS. Could restrict smoking in pub gardens and outdoor restaurants. Naomi Thompson from Action on Smoking and Health, ICHNI, with us today. Morning, Naomi.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. So, grown adults deciding that they want to have a smoke, and if it became illegal for them to make that decision in a pub garden or an outdoor restaurant, what right has the state to intervene in their lives?
I think what we have to say is smoke-free places, as being potentially suggested, will protect our 86% of our population, our adult population, who don't smoke. It will also protect...
Outdoor?
Yes, because secondhand smoke contains particulate matter, which clings to clothing, it clings to surroundings, and people breathe that in, and that's what causes damage. It will thicken your blood if you breathe in secondhand smoke. It can make asthma worse. It can lead to long-term conditions such as cancer. So we need to think about our protecting the non-smoker, but also the smokers who have decided that maybe they want to quit. Many smokers do want to quit, and actually the social situation is their hardest situation. And they would love to go out, continue their life as they did do, but without the cigarette, and that's really difficult
well,
to
you
do.
Well, you could draw a comparison between these smokers who you're saying they you don't want them, if they're trying to quit, distracted from people smoking around them. You could draw a comparison to me trying to lose weight and ban everybody eating a Mars bar.
I think the difference between food and cigarettes is food we have to take in to survive. Cigarettes are not an essential in life. Now, I will say smokers can be very highly addicted, and this is what makes it really, really difficult. But smoking is still our biggest preventable killer here in Northern Ireland. It costs our health service around about £218 million a year to treat. What are preventable illnesses?
What about the business owners? How's it going to affect their livelihoods? Bar owner John Biddles, how will it affect you, John, if this came in?
Well, Stephen, we do, like, I'm an odd smoker myself. We do have people sit outside or, like, you know, and there's a lot of bars and restaurants who have invested thousands, tens of thousands on outdoor smoking areas. And I think the whole idea of banning the whole lot, team, I think they've lost their run of themselves. Yes, you can put up all the arguments about, you know, cancer, about this, but, you know, if people want to sit outside, and they want to have a few pints, and they want to have a sit out, get a bit of air about them. You know, personally, like, where do you draw the line? You can't go about saying, right...
But do you want someone puffing a big dirty fag sitting beside you?
You know, but Stephen, I find all the smoking areas, the outdoor gardens, most of the people sit out there are non-smokers. Like, at the end of the day, a lot
of... But then
of
what's the problem with saying it's a non-smoking environment? What's the problem?
No, Stephen, there's still people that want to go outside. Like, there's a guy who come down here the other day, he brings down a cigar, he sits here. We have a lot of elderly customers.
And it all wafts into your nostrils.
Ah, Stephen, it doesn't waft into nobody's nostrils. Stephen,
we have a man but where's the smoke
there,
go?
And he's in his 90s. He comes down, he makes his way down from East Belfast. He comes down here, he sits and has a few drinks. He sits outside and smokes his pipe. There's another guy who comes down, he sits and smokes his pipe. It's all part of coming to the pub. It's all part of, you know, are you going to say to people, like, I was driving down to work this morning, and are you going to say to people at the bus stop, you know, don't be smoking at the bus stop, you know, stand on the other side of the road, don't be standing in the bus shelter. You know, you're going to, Stephen, a lot of people are, and, you know, they've created outdoor areas, outdoor gardens, they've spent tens of thousands, they have, and then a lot of non-smokers have started to quit indeed.
Naomi, how would you respond to this?
I think the reality is, with regard to smoking, we know our 200,000 out of our 300,000 smokers in Northern Ireland will die from their smoking. We have to do something about that. We have to protect our health service. And we have to look after, yes, our smokers who want to quit smoking. And the reality is, we're not saying people can't smoke. We're just saying we need to protect the non-smokers, we need to protect the smokers who are wanting to make a change, and we need to protect children and young people so they don't actually see that as a future. You know, there's lots, the majority of our population want smoke-free places, and the reality is any venue that will sell food, you know, people will still go there if it's smoke-free.
John Laverty is the night editor for the Belfast Telegraph. Are you a smoker, John?
I was, Stephen. Good morning. I was a smoker up until almost 20 years ago, and I enjoyed smoking when I did it. But this isn't really this isn't really a health debate, Stephen. This is a debate about business and people's rights. And I can understand why somebody like John Bittles is actually concerned about this, because this is going to, you know, if this rule comes in, it is going to affect, local hospitality businesses, and it's going to affect people's rights as well. Because, I mean, ever since COVID, for instance, more and more people are drinking at home now. They're drinking at home with the cheaper booze they get from supermarkets. And if they're drinking at home and they're smokers, they're also smoking at home. Now, one of our correspondents there is talking about, you know, the rights of, you know, the children and young people, and I agree with that. But it's a lot more dangerous smoking at home when your kids are around than smoking outside a bar. And also, the thing of it is, The smoking outside bars is actually a refreshing, in one sense of the word, social thing. You know, people who wouldn't normally speak to each other in a bar speak to each other outside a bar because they have something in common. And that is, they're both enjoying a cigarette. I just think this is Labour trying to push things too far with nanny state politics.
Let's see what Kieran in Belfast thinks. Morning, Kieran.
Morning, Stephen. So I think this is a brilliant idea. And I am a smoker. A brilliant idea.
Why?
Because, put it this way, I'm a smoker. I do not like smoking. Now, that might sound mad to you, but it's the truth. Now, see, the more things that they enforce in stopping smokers having, it means that it benefits me because I can't do them things that I would be able to do before.
Just go somewhere else for a wee shifty fag, won't you?
No, it's the God honest truth.
Of course you will. You'll walk out onto the street.
No, I wouldn't. If I was in a restaurant and they stopped, you can out. No way you can go out into that. Or, what do they call it? A wee garden? Garden?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, when you go out there, it's actually disgusting, Stephen, and that's from a smoker. See, when you're smoking on your own or whatever, you're on your own. But see, when there's a crowd of people around you, having to smoke, it's actually not good at all. It's not. I know that sounds crazy, but do you understand being a smoker and do you having that addiction?
We'll squeeze in Robert, the taxi driver, as well. Morning, Robert.
Morning, Stephen. I think this is ludicrous. You've no alternative but to breathe in the pollution that comes out of vehicles. The biggest majority of vehicles on the road are diesels. It's highly pollutant. You're breathing it in every day of the week. You've no choice.
Well, you drive those, don't you? You're a black taxi driver.
I'm a black taxi driver. But the sad reality with not only a black taxi driver and all taxi drivers, we are not subsidised like TransLink to go electric. A new London taxi is £65,000, Stephen. We'll have to get down and stand outside Mahay Island and ask you to lend us £65,000 to get us a nice electric vehicle.
I'm surprised you're up early. Even to phone the Nolan Show this morning. Surprised you're up out of your bed. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, John Laverty, John Bittles, Naomi Thompson. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. We'll see you tomorrow morning for more Nolan at 9.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.